The following Dharma talk was recorded in April 2014 in St. Louis, Missouri. It is one of two recordings from the retreat called Kind-Hearted Awareness, taught by Rebecca Bradshaw. The retreat was sponsored by Mid-America Dharma. If you like this recording, you can find more talks at www.midamericadharma.org. For questions, we welcome your emails sent to info@midamericadharma.org. Rebecca Bradshaw is the guiding teacher at the Insight Meditation Center of Pioneer Valley in East Hampton, Massachusetts. She has been practicing Vipassana meditation since 1983 and teaching since 1993. Her teaching explores the convergence of love and wisdom. More information about Rebecca can be found at www.insightpv.org.
Good evening. You all have survived your first day or just about survived it. Looks like you're going to make it. So tonight I want to talk more about mindfulness and kindness or loving kindness. Pull together some of the things we were talking about today. So one thing we were talking about is mindfulness as a non-judgmental awareness, which means an awareness based in open-heartedness. Trungpa Rinpoche, who I like a lot of his teachings, he was once asked the essence of the Buddha's teachings, or he was asked often the essence of the Buddha's teachings, and he would say, "It is very simple. It is simply the teaching of openness, complete openness. Turn towards everything." So that's what mindfulness is about, this turning towards everything or turning towards whatever arises as a manifestation of life in this moment, and to do it with as much open-heartedness as we can, or over time to learn how to do it with more and more open-heartedness. So we connect with this life with curiosity. We've talked about that, curiosity and freshness. Learning to be alive and awake, and then to use this sense of connectedness and this sense of aliveness to learn about life and how it works and how one can be happy and living in the kind of universe that we have taken birth in, this universe of constant change. We often teach the practices of Vipassana and loving kindness separately, but I see them as very interwoven. When our meditation practice is based in a feeling of metta or love or open-heartedness, it gives us the space to be curious about our experience rather than judgmental. When we're judging experience, we can't learn from it. We've distorted it by the very judgment or the condemning of it. And so metta really helps to soften the heart so that it can really connect with experience and therefore then learn from it. So you could say that the non-judgmental quality of metta leads to clearer seeing and therefore deeper wisdom. And out of this comes the transformation that we so desire. The mindfulness practice develops wisdom by a deep seeing into the way life is. And the real purpose of Vipassana practice is to actually deconstruct conventional reality and to challenge our notions about how the world is, to challenge our views about permanence and happiness and self. So all of these are challenged and revised through mindfulness practice. That might be more than you were signing up for. But that's the deepest purpose of mindfulness practice. And all of this meaning to lead towards a deep kind of peace or a deep kind of happiness. the happiness of letting go, the happiness of non-clinging. I'll probably talk more about that tomorrow night. Metta practice is the softening of the heart in this process of developing wisdom. And its strength is its inclusivity, the acceptance of all that arises. Metta says, yes, you too, or yes, this too. And this attitude of metta gives us the strength and the courage to have a truly embodied practice, one that includes all of our being, the mental, emotional, physical, all of it. I was recently reading a Shambhala Sun magazine, and Ram Dass said, the path of love doesn't go anywhere. It just brings you more here, into the present moment, into the reality of who you already are. It takes you out of your mind and into your heart. I like the first part, the path of love doesn't go anywhere. It just goes right here, which is where we're trying to arrive anyway. Sometimes we have this such a goal-oriented feeling about our practice that there's somewhere we're going to try to get to. We're not trying to get anywhere except here. And the great news is here is always present. It's always an option. It doesn't give up on you. Metta is a quality that makes us so strong. I mentioned the other day that, or yesterday or today, I don't know when I mentioned it. Sometime I mentioned it that I went to Burma. So I tend to go to Burma every other year to a monastery in the Sagaing Hills region near Mandalay. We have a 3-week retreat that we do there with a Burmese master, and I taught it some, but fortunately I don't have to teach it now and I get to sit it more. And what we have a few friends in the hills, monks and nuns that we visit, and these are people who've been practicing their whole lives. And there's one that we call the happy monk because he's so happy. So last time I visited him, I think he was 96. It's unclear, 96, 98, somewhere in that region. And a number of years ago, I thought it might be a good idea to find out why he was so happy. Maybe we good information. So I asked him one day, I said, well, why are you so happy? And he said, because I have no ill will towards anyone. And metta is often described as the absence of ill will, especially traditionally. So he says, I have no ill will towards anyone. I have no ill will towards you. And I have no ill will towards you. And I have no ill will towards the snakes. And I have, and he went on and on like this. And he's very expressive. He kind of bubbles and is very alive. He's my role model for metta. He's just, you'd be in his presence. You can feel the strength of that kind of quality of love. He laughs a lot. Very happy person. We have another monk that we visit, and we call him Angel Sayadaw. Because he's also very, very, has very deep metta, but it manifests very differently. He's very quiet. And when I go into his monastery, it's like, I feel like sometimes the metta is so thick that I almost feel like I have to part it with my hands to be able to walk through it. I feel like I'm in an ocean kind of a metta. And he's just very quiet. We think of him like an angel. And then there's Deepama, who came to teach at IMS when I was there for my first retreat, an Indian woman. And her metta, very strong metta, somebody once asked her, what's in your mind? And she said, three things, love, concentration, and what was the third one? I'm going to forget it. Might have been mindfulness. Peace. No, love, concentration, and peace. Wouldn't that be kind of cool? And, but her, she had this metta that was kind of fierce, no nonsense. real, like, she held you to your highest standard. And she used to go around blessing things. They took her to the Boston Aquarium once, and she'd be blessing the fish, and she would bless airplanes, and she just liked to bless everything. Such a beautiful quality. So with this quality of metta, as we develop it within ourselves, it helps us to develop this more intimate relationship with our experience. It allows us to get to know ourselves more deeply, which is really the same as getting to know life. We are life. That's what we are. And it's not about creating some perfect state, because life isn't perfect. It's about connecting to what is. We have to hear this over and over again because we keep forgetting. It's great intimacy with our own experience. Pema Chodron says, loving kindness, metta, towards ourselves doesn't mean getting rid of anything. Metta means that we can still be crazy after all these years. We can still be angry after all these years. We can still be timid or jealous or full of feelings of unworthiness. The point is not to try to change ourselves. Meditation practice isn't about trying to throw ourselves away and become something better. It's about befriending who we already are. The ground of practice is you or me or whoever we are right now, just as we are. That's the ground. That's what we study. That's what we come to know with tremendous curiosity and interest. So we are talking about how we tend to, in the Western and the modern world, live in our thoughts and rely on our thoughts as the way to experience the world. And because of this, many of us have a deep alienation, actually, from our sense experience, which is how we evolved. We evolved relying on our senses for thousands and thousands of years. And modern society, as it's become more predictable and controllable, we've lost that contact with our senses, and we live primarily in our heads. And we seem to be heading more and more that way. And there's a sense of homelessness that we feel because of that. We miss that connection to our embodied selves. And so meditation really helps us come out of this dream world of our head and connect through our senses. You could say that awakening is coming to our senses. So we experience the breath. We experience the foot on the ground. We experience the sound of the wind. We experience the taste of the mushroom. Really enjoyed the taste of the mushroom at dinner. I was like, why? If they're earthy, aren't they? They have an earthy taste. I was really enjoying that connection. I felt the connection with the earth through eating the mushroom. Or we enjoy the sight of the flowers. I was enjoying looking at the tulips out there, and it's a pretty cool purple one. As I was telling you yesterday, I like to look like at flowers, like look right into them. And wow, it's pretty cool. It was really nice. You should check them out. They're quite beautiful. So we connect like this very viscerally with our senses, because that's actually what life is. I mean, life can be thoughts in the head, but we know that if we spend too much time in our thoughts, we feel like we're missing something, don't we? We feel poor. Starved for something. A sense of lack. We feel a sense of lack. And what we're lacking is that visceral connection. So we practice this. We practice connecting with breath, sensation, sound, taste, seeing, feeling in the body, emotions, all that it means to be fully alive. We develop the sense of being full-heartedly here. We receive life through this sensitive system that we call the body, mind and body together. The Buddha said, in this fathom-long body, the whole universe can be discovered. We can discover suffering and the end of suffering. We can discover truth through this body. So it's enough to sit here and connect with the universe through this body and develop understanding. So in meditation, we have this emphasis then on coming to our sensory experience as it is. And it sounds easy, but it is a process, because the habit of retreating to the safety of our thoughts is so deep that it takes time to cultivate the willingness to be here nakedly in the present moment. And I don't want us to make thoughts an enemy. I hope that's very clear. They're our vacation. They're protection. Sometimes they're useful too, you know, we have to plan things like that. But they're our protection, so we don't have to make an enemy out of them. But we can try, and you have been all day, I know, coming back to the sense, to the body, to here, to now. And we can explore what the difference between thinking about our experience and experiencing it. And so we can explore the difference between thinking about a breath and a breath, feeling the breath. Like, what's that difference? So thinking about a breath, it's kind of maybe on the surface, and then experiencing the breath, maybe we experience warmth and coolness and tingling and stretching and throbbing and contraction and pressure and movement. So that's what we get to, that level of actually feeling our senses, our experiences, smoothness, roughness. Or hearing, what's the difference between hearing and thinking about thoughts? We can notice that too. One time I was canoeing with my partner, and it was pretty early spring, I think. We like to go canoeing. So we were up on a pond in New Hampshire, and there were these tree frogs. And I don't know if you know about tree frogs, but they're kind of shrill. They have this shrill. And we were really enjoying the sound of the tree frogs. And then somebody was shooting a gun in the woods, and we were not enjoying the sound of the guns. I was having to work with aversion, and it was actually interesting to just watch how we related to those two different sounds. And at one point, my partner turns to me and he says, "I wonder if we didn't know that the frogs, that shrill sound was the frogs, and didn't know that those gunshots were a gunshot, if we'd have the preference that we have." So in some ways, like, our experience of those two different sounds was, a lot of it was through our thoughts about the sounds, like our thoughts that somebody was shooting a gun and our thoughts that they were frogs. It was very interesting, because the frog sound actually wasn't that pleasant, but it was pleasant because it was frogs. It was fun to watch or to... One time somebody asked Suzuki Roshi this complicated question about consciousness, and he said, "I don't know anything about consciousness. I'm just trying to teach my students to hear the birds sing." Or walking, like, what's our idea of our leg and our foot, but what's the actual experience as we're walking? I'm hoping you're seeing that the experience is this changing field of sensation. And the thought of a leg and a foot is pretty solid, right? It doesn't, that's one reason why we want to get to the level of sensations, is so that we can see change. The level of a leg and a foot, it doesn't feel very much like it changes, but when you're really with it, when you're walking, you see that all of these sensations are changing all the time. something that we think is solid and permanent is actually now fluid and impermanent. We want to see life as it is, and we do that best by directly connecting to our senses. Wei Wu Wei, Taoist master, said that we worship the teapot instead of drinking the tea. So we're trying to learn how to drink the tea. It takes a certain kind of trust or faith or willingness to meet life with this much openness, to meet life without defensiveness. It's the connection we all crave because it's home. And yet we have some ambivalence about it too. That's why we retreat often to our thoughts. We're not so sure. Life is intense. Who was it? T.S. Eliot, I think, said, most people can't bear too much reality. We're trying to learn how to bear reality. And we'll take off sometimes into our thoughts. It's okay. There's a poem that I like. I'm not so sure. It might take a few readings to get what he's trying to say, but I'm going to only read it once, and if you get it, great. Tony Hoagland, it's from his book called What Narcissism Means to Me, which is like, it's a great title. For me, somehow this poem represents the yearning that we have to connect and the trepidation we have about it, the protectedness we want to keep. He says, this year it seems like everyone is getting tattoos, sharks and Chinese characters, hummingbirds and musical notes. But the tattoo I would like to get is of a fist and a rose. But I can't tell you how they will fit together on my shoulder. If the rose is inside the fist, it will be crushed or hidden. If the fist is closed, as a fist by definition is, it cannot reach out and touch the rose. Yet the only tattoo I want is of a fist and a rose together. Fist that helps you survive. Rose without which you have no reason to. There's that line, yet the only tattoo I want is of a fist and a rose together. Ultimately, we want to touch the rose, and we're willing to risk opening the fist to do it. And mindfulness and kindness gives us the tools to be able to. So I'll talk a little bit more about mindfulness. My teacher coined an acronym that actually is used around a bunch now, I think. It's RAIN, R-A-I-N. For four qualities of mindfulness, RAIN. So the first one, R, is for recognition. So one part of mindfulness is we want to recognize what's going on. And the mental noting that I talked about this morning can sometimes be helpful. That little whispered word helps us to know actually what is going on in the moment. Can help if we're confused sometimes to use the noting. So R for recognition, A for acceptance, which I feel like I've been talking about ever since I got here, right? Aiming towards that non-judgmental attention. So the usual way, and sometimes this is so subtle, it's unconscious. It's like every moment we judge every moment. Is this okay? Is this not okay? How do I want this to be different? I actually went through a period in my practice where I would notice that each breath, I would judge each breath. Like, is this breath okay? Was that breath good? Could it have been better? Just this, like, deep tendency to judge. So with acceptance, we're trying to move away from judgment and settle more into a non-judgmental attention. It's kind of a radical surrender of letting go of perfection, of fixing ourselves. Of course, the messages we get societally are constantly about fixing ourselves. So we have an upriver canoe paddle, you could say, in this regard. One of the things I like to do when I fly is find messages that I call anti-dharma. It's not too hard to do. So one I came across in it's all you have to do is read the airline magazine to get some good ones. These are all, I have three here that are all from the airline magazines. This one says, "Your prettiest you." It's a picture of two beautiful young women. Renowned makeup artist Bobby Brown believes women should, quote, look and feel like themselves, only prettier and more confident, end quote. This was like said with a straight face, I think. Isn't that great? What a conundrum. We should look and feel like ourselves, only prettier and more confident. Okay. And then there's one for men. So this is for men. Refind your prime. Men, let's be men again. Course, court, or rugged trails, let's take back what time has taken. And there's this whole thing about, I think it's just testosterone they're going to give you. Don't let your age beat you. Refine your prime. And then, yes, those were from another trip. This is from yesterday. America's top five anti-aging super solutions. That's for people my age and above. Here they are, the top five anti-aging superstars everyone is talking about. As we all know, in today's youth-obsessed culture, looking young, radiant, and vibrant isn't just about vanity. It's about keeping your edge and staying competitive. Whoa. Growth hormone therapy is number one. I didn't take pages two through five. I don't know what they are. So we get this all over the place, right? That we need to be fixed and improved and upgraded and, all of that. That's not the tact that we're taking here in, meditation. We're actually taking the radical track that maybe you're okay just as you are. That doesn't mean that there aren't qualities that we may want to develop or qualities that we may want to discourage. It sounds kind of contradictory, but it's not. Suzuki Roshi was once addressing a bunch of students and he says, "You're all perfect just as you are, and you have some work to do." And I like that. That's balanced. But the second doesn't contradict the first. Do you get that? We're all human. Here's a poem from Ryokan, one of my favorite Zen poets. "Today's begging is finished. At the crossroads, I wander by the side of the Buddha shrine, talking with some children. Last year, a foolish monk. This year, no change." There's so much acceptance and love in that. I was talking last night about Ajahn Chah and how he described meditation. Put a chair in the middle of a room, sit in the chair, see who comes to visit. And he also says, "Speak with them here and you will know every one of them well." So there's this sense of intimacy and getting to know all these visitors that arrive. It's very open and accepting. And it's kind of interesting for ourselves to see which visitors do we accept and which ones do we exile. What experiences of life do we exile? Is it pain? Is it anger? Is it unpleasant sounds? What is it that we find unacceptable as part of our human life. And what we do is we find that limit. Where is the limit of what we find unacceptable and what we exile, and we stretch. We stretch to include. So we play the limits of our willingness to meet life. So the question might be, how much of life is acceptable? We stretch that. My teacher used to say that before she started practice, 95% of life was unacceptable to her. It's about right. 100% of our life is worthy of our attention. That's what increases. And metta means that we greet each visitor with kindness. So that limit where we practice is that visitor that we want to ignore or to banish or to exile. How large can the compassionate space of our heart get? That's what we stretch, that compassionate space of heart. So we can check whether we include a spirit of acceptance and open-heartedness in our practice. And a lot of this is looking at our relationship to our experience. Are we trying to understand, or are we trying to purge something? Are we trying to connect with our life, or are we trying to control it? We check this out. We can't force kind-hearted awareness, but we can incline the mind towards it. We can plant seeds that will one day sprout if we keep watering them. So R for recognition, A for acceptance, I for interest. So this is very closely related to curiosity. So with mindfulness, we become deeply interested in experience. Again, all of it, the happiness, the sorrow, the pleasure, the pain. What is joy? What is grief? What is boredom? What is a knee pain? What is a breath? When I was on retreat, I was teaching in this monastery in northern Burma, Sayadaw Lakana, the head of the monastery. He once gave two talks on the pain you feel in the buttocks when you sit for a long time. And, they were 75 minutes each. So we knew what he was talking about, but like, that's interest. Like, could you talk 150 minutes on the pain in the buttocks when you sit for a long time? It's great. Another time he spent like one and a half talks, I think it was, talking about 1/6 of a step that you take in walking meditation. Those Burmese, they really know how to get into the details. Rumi says, sell your cleverness and purchase bewilderment. Bewilderment meaning that quality of interest, of not knowing. So in some ways we're trying to access the not knowing mind. We know so much. That's what I try to do when I look in flowers. Like if I know that's a flower, I see my ideas of a flower. But if I can suspend knowing that that's a flower and I can just rest in seeing, then it's magical. So we're trying to develop this kind of beginner's mind is sometimes what it's called also. Looking for freshness, looking for eyes that can see a breath like you've never seen one before. I worked for many years, I might have mentioned this last night, I worked for many years in community mental health in the inner city. And because I speak Spanish, I worked with Puerto Ricans. And one day one of my clients was with me, and she'd just been in the country for a few months. And she's sitting there looking out the window. She goes, "Rebecca, there's this beautiful bird out there." And I love birds. So I was like, "Oh, really?" So I went to look, and I looked, and I said, "Oh, that's just a blue jay. They're very common." And I thought about it afterwards, and I was like, who saw that blue jay? I didn't see the blue jay. I saw my idea of the blue jay. She saw the blue jay. Now, she had beginner's mind because it was fresh to her, right? But ever since then, I really look at blue jays, and they are actually quite beautiful birds. We have this idea that they're common and they're a pest. I learned a lot from that exchange. That's what I mean with trying to see freshly. There's so much that we assume and we fill in. We learn to practice seeing it all new. My partner is a dean at a community college, and he works with a lot of non-credit courses, and so he went to this first day that a glass blowing workshop was happening. And this is what the teacher said. He liked it so much he came back and told me, because he knew it'd be good for meditation. And the glass blowing teacher said to the students, "I want you to slow down and savor being a beginner. As an artist, I've been doing this for 30 years, and I spend most of my time trying to get back to seeing that glass as a beginner." So we've been living this life for 30 years, 40 years, 50 years, 25 years, however many years, and we're trying to get back to seeing this life as a beginner. Slow down, savor it. Interest, then. Recognition, acceptance, and interest. I read somewhere that the Buddha said that mindfulness was like the salt in curries, that it spices up everything and brings out the flavor, gives it taste. So we can learn to relate to our lives with this kind of powerful interest that accepts it all. I have a student who was diagnosed with Parkinson's, and she said to me, thank God that she'd practiced before, because now she was using every bit of it. And she was such an inspiration to me. She said, "I want to live this experience." What an attitude of open-heartedness, no? One time she said to me, "I wouldn't trade this experience. Parkinson's is my meditation." She also said, "Tell people the Dharma works. If you practice when you need it, it's there." So love transforms judgment and rejection to interest and compassion. She's truly interested in her experience. So the N, R-A-I-N, the N stands for non-identification and non-clinging. This is sometimes more difficult to understand. What it means is working with our tendency to take experience too personally and to fabricate around it. Or noticing and learning to work with what I call stickiness. So what we usually do when an experience arises in this body, mind, heart, is we say, "Oh, that's me, that's mine." And and it becomes sticky. we get over-involved with it and take it very personally and fabricate around it. For example, anger arises. And there's a way that we can be with anger mindfully. We'll talk about this more tomorrow morning. But at some point, if we start to take it as my anger, then it starts getting sticky. and it starts becoming super personal, when actually anger is just this energy that arises and passes away. It's part of being human. There's a lot of sirens around here. it's part of being a human being. You want to try a little experiment. Maybe let's try a little experiment to see if it works, to understand a little bit what I'm saying. So think of an emotion that comes fairly easily to you, and let's make it an afflictive emotion, you can make it a happy emotion, any emotion. Let's try with any emotion. Think of an emotion that comes easily to you. You can close your eyes if you want. And then say, okay, so I am whatever it is. I am angry, or I am afraid, or I am joyful, whatever. Just say that I am, and then the emotion. And just notice how that feels. Now I want you to change it and say, anger feels like this, or joy feels like this, or whatever the emotion is, feels like this. Try that. Okay, so you can open your eyes. Was there a difference for you between the first and the second experience? And if so, what was it? You can actually say, what was the difference between the two? It could leave in the second one, so there's more space. All right, so the first one was kind of more permanent, and the second one had more space. Mm-hmm. You couldn't do the second one. Okay. All right. Nothing happened. Anybody else? Detached. Okay. Uh-huh. Yeah. Opened up. Okay. So is somebody else? Oh, okay, great. So in some ways, this is what we're trying. The first one, I was encouraging you to identify with the emotion, as we call it in Buddhism, and that tends to be stickier, seems more permanent, more contracted. And then the second one, I was encouraging you to play with the flavor of non-identification, that the anger feels like this, or whatever the emotion feels like this. And you notice there's a little more space. It wasn't as sticky. There's openness, curiosity. Yeah, so that was just a little taste of what we mean when we talk about non-identification. It doesn't mean that that it's not happening, but it's happening with a certain kind of spaciousness that doesn't take it so personally. It's not personal. Anger is not personal. It's ours to deal with. There's a paradox here again. Yeah, if I get angry a lot, I need to deal with that. And when it happens and I'm sitting here, yes, it's my experience. That's one side. But the other side is it's just this universal experience that arises and it passes away and that all humans feel. And that's the non-identification. So it's like we take responsibility. But the non-identification is we don't add a whole level of contraction on top of it. And this is one of the qualities of mindfulness, or one of the aspects of mindfulness. And with this second way, it's you could say that mindfulness unfreezes reality. Attachment and conceptual thinking freeze reality. And mindfulness unfreezes it. It flows more. We see the flowing nature of things. Does that make sense? A little bit? So perhaps freedom is about how we hold, about how lightly we can hold this changing world. all the experiences that happen within this heart, mind, body. Oh, it's getting late. I knew that would happen. So in this way, mindfulness is meant to help us connect more with the truth of how life is so that we learn to let go and learn the peace and freedom of letting go. So part of it's to connect, to be here. It's wonderful to connect and be here, but part of it's also to learn from that. And when we're judging, we can't learn. When we are watching and loving, as I said last night, we can learn. So when we are practicing, we want to look at the kind of effort that we're making. And is the kind of effort that we're making, is it a kind of forceful effort or is it a kind of effort? Again, is it effort meant to control or purge experience, or is it effort made to connect and to love experience or to include experience? Most of us try too hard. There's an edge to our effort, and then often even an aggression to our effort that isn't helpful. For many years, I led the teen retreat at IMS for 18 years. I actually worked it and led it for maybe 12 years. And this was my last year I let it go. Getting too old. They need younger people to lead it. And there was, the one thing that was really fun about that retreat is there are 20 volunteers. And so we'd have our own little sangha of volunteers of, there were about 60 kids and 20 volunteers. And there's this one volunteer, I love dearly, named Dave, and he's from Tennessee. And, Dave, kind of big guy, full of tattoos, arms completely full of tattoos, and kind of had a look, you know, like a, kind of a big tough guy. And he was telling the story of one time when he was on retreat. And, I don't know if you've noticed this even this time or when you're on retreat in general, but when there's not a lot of new stimulation, the bulletin board becomes kind of a big deal. Like, do you walk by the bulletin board and just kind of look at it, right? Like, what's going on the bulletin board? So at IMS, when you come out of the meditation hall, like the way the bulletin board's positioned is right in front of you. And Dave was talking to me one day and he's like, you know, when you come out meditation hall and you're just hoping there's a note for you. There's something for you there. And he goes, I used to write notes to myself and put them up there. So I said, Dave, what did your notes say? He said, well, one note said, you're trying hard enough. And I really like that. You're trying hard enough. That sense of giving ourselves a little bit of space and not pushing so much, right? Most of us push too much. You're trying hard enough. What a great idea. I was watching some of you watch the cows before I came into the talk tonight, and I thought maybe the cows are good role models, you know? They're not trying too hard. Right? They're just standing there, just chilling, pretty grounded. Whatever role model works. I learned some things about this by practicing Qigong, which I've been practicing for a number of years. And when I first started the class, the teacher talked about the 70% rule. She said that my knee's getting sore. She said that in Qigong, you go about 70% of what you can do. And I found that totally unacceptable. I'm 120% kind of gal. I'm not a 70% kind of gal. So I thought, well, the 70% rule, that's for everybody else. 95 for me. And I started to pay attention when I would make effort in Qigong. And what I started to realize is that when I was going, 90%, 100%, what I was really trying to do was bypass my experience. I was really trying to kind of plow through what was actually really happening for me. And that when I would back up to 70%, then I would start to feel what was happening for me. It's really interesting. So you might want to try the 70% rule. Not like come to 70% of the sittings. I don't mean it like that. But like when you find yourself kind of like working something a lot, like what's it like to like back up just a little bit? I bet you'll find out a lot more than when you're going for 95 or 100%. All right, it's late. Let's see how we can end the talk. Let's see which of my stories you get for the end. Trungpa Rinpoche says again, I would like to say, ladies and gentlemen, that you shouldn't be afraid of who you are. That's the first key idea. You shouldn't be afraid of who you are. You should not be afraid of who you are. It's very important to realize this. I think of meditation as teaching us not to be afraid of who we are. And then last, this is a story from Jack Kornfield's book, After the Ecstasy, Then the Laundry. And he interviewed a bunch of teachers and senior students who had awakening experiences and asked them what it was like afterwards. Afterwards, you had to do the laundry. After the ecstasy, then the laundry. And one teacher, unnamed teacher, said, in many ways, the spiritual transformation of the past decades is different than I had imagined. I'm still the same quirky person with much the same style and ways of being. So that on the outside, I'm not like that amazingly transformed, enlightened person I first hoped to become. But there's a big transformation inside. Years of working with my feelings and family patterns and temper have softened the way I hold them all. In the struggle to know and deeply accept my life, it has been transformed, and my love has grown larger. If my life was like a crowded garage where I kept bumping into the furniture and judging myself, now it's like I've moved into an airplane hangar with the doors left open. I've got the same old stuff there, yet it doesn't limit me like before. I'm the same, yet now I'm free to move about, even to fly.